From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Monday, March the 23rd, 2020. We start a new week in the age of coronavirus today, and we are going to be talking quite a bit about this issue on the Dave Graham Show today. We're going to be speaking with a couple of people in the first hour who are have their fingers on the pulse of what is going on in Vermont's low-income communities. John Sales from the Vermont Food Bank is going to be joining me right off, and then Sue Minter from Capstone Community Action is going to be my guest in the second half hour of the program this morning. A little later on, we're going to be speaking with Tim Ash, Senate President Pro Tem. He's been kind enough to offer to come on here and just sort of give us the latest word on what's going on in the statewide response, coordinating all of the different state agencies and so on. And then Mike Donahue, a longtime Vermont journalist, is going to talk to us about some of the issues he's running into with all these virtual meetings that are going on, and how open can they be? Are folks trying to close off some meetings? We'll talk to Mike about what he's finding out there on the Daily Beat toward the end of the show this morning. So it's a good full show. As always, we welcome calls from our listeners. And I just want to add a little bit of extra word on that, which is that if any of you folks out there are having, you know, particular problems or struggles or whatever, I don't know that we're going to be able to solve them at WDEV, but if we might have some ideas for you know, whom you might need to call and that kind of thing. I know these are very, very tough times for people. A lot of worry out there, understandable. And, you know, we want to be there for you and help out in any way we can. So don't be shy about calling the program. We're at 244-1777. That's the local number in Waterbury. Toll-free number is 1-877-291-8255. And we certainly do love to hear from our listeners. As I mentioned, we're going to be talking right off the bat here with John Sales of the Vermont Food Bank, who I believe is on the phone with us at the moment. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Dave. Glad to be here.
And I thank you very much for joining me. I know these are busy times for anybody in a position like yours, where you are certainly in charge of a large public service agency. And so I doubly appreciate your willingness to come on and fill us in. I want to find out from you, first off, I trust you are well and that your folks there are doing okay.
We are. Thank you for asking. Yes. You know, we're very, very aware of the health of our employees, because it's critical that we be able to continue to do our job. You were mentioning earlier, you know, people needing help. We have an employee who called in and said he had a fever yesterday, called our HR director. And actually, I connected with 211 and through them the Vermont Health Department to make sure we were following the latest updates on policies for how to sustain business operations. They were so helpful. And I would really encourage anyone who has questions and you don't know where to get an answer to try just dial 211. They're really, really helpful. And if they can't answer your question, they will connect you with who can.
That's a great piece of information there, John. Thank you so much for that. I certainly hope that, you know, your employee is maybe he's got a seasonal flu or something, the regular stuff.
And there's a lot going on. And, you know, it was just one mild symptom. So, we're very helpful, but you want to be as cautious as you can.
Absolutely. That is the word. How many employees does the food bank have now?
Well, we are a statewide organization. We have facilities in Barrie, in Rutland, and in Brattleboro, and we have 61 full-time employees.
I see. Okay. And obviously they are, I would think, you know, a lot of what you do is shipping food. You're moving it around to where it needs to be. And you can't really phone that in. Most people are still coming into work.
That's right. You know, our drivers and our warehouse selectors and just our operations team are amazingly dedicated. And in fact, our chief operating officer called all of our drivers this weekend just to check in with them. And to a to an individual, they said, well, of course I'm coming to work. You know, this is what we do, and this work needs to be done. You know, we're doing everything we can to keep our staff healthy. You know, it's we deal with food, and food safety and cleanliness is number one. So a lot of the things that people are being advised to do, you know, wash your hands, you know, wear gloves, all the cleanliness activities are things that we usually do anyway here.
So they're already baked into the cake, so to speak.
That's right. And so, you know, we're hopeful, but you never know. And we're obviously, you know, we have our coronavirus task force here at the food bank that's meeting twice a day and making contingency plans for, you know, in case some of our people do get sick. We want to make sure that we can continue to operate. I'll also point out the food bank is part of the state emergency operations plan. We're a secondary responder, so we are tied into everything that's happening at the emergency operations center and with all the state agencies.
When in normal times, does the food bank make individual deliveries to households, or is that done by local food shelves more if people are, say shut-ins or whatever?
Yeah, that's more local food shelves, and we're actually relying heavily on those partners right now. They're really, really responding and ramping up. You know, a lot of the schools also, with schools being closed, are passing out breakfast and lunch to many, many kids across the state, and we're coordinating with them, and also our 215 partners, the food shelves and meal sites and shelters around the state. A lot of them are doing home delivery now. In fact, Feeding Chittenden, which is the biggest food shelf in the state in Burlington, has always had a home delivery program, and they've about doubled the number of home delivered meals and home delivered groceries that they're doing because the demand is rising, and we want to make sure that people that are most at risk aren't putting themselves and others in the community at risk. So we're very, very thankful to everyone who's stepping up and making that happen across the state.
Are you having any supply chain issues, any products that you normally delivered which you can't right now?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we have a tremendous amount of food on order now. As soon as we saw that this was hitting, we started placing orders. In fact, when I got in this morning, there was a tractor trailer pulling into our berry facility with a full of produce. We've more than doubled. Actually tripled the amount of food that we've ordered because we know that the demand is going to be increasing substantially. As I said, there's a truck here today. It's starting to be delivered. We're monitoring supply chains every day, and it looks like things are getting tight. We haven't heard of any of our deliveries being canceled yet, but it's really a day-by-day situation.
Have you seen much yet impact from all of the economic dislocation out there? In other words, I would imagine in a time of, you know, higher unemployment, for instance, demand on your services increases, and we certainly are in a time of higher unemployment right now.
Yes. You know, the entire hospitality industry has shut down now. Gyms and salons, even, you know, a lot of people, particularly hourly employees, are not working. They're not getting paid. What we've seen so far, we do what we call Veggie Van Gogh, which is like a farmer's market style distribution, which has now switched to all prepackaged bags. So it's a more of a grab and go. We do it every month at the Northeastern Vermont Regional Hospital up in St. Johnsbury. An average, they get about 200 families. Last week we had one, there were 400 families. We did ours at the Winooski School in Winooski, the JFK school. Usually we have about 400 families that go to that Veggie Van Gogh. And this week we served about 650. And so we're seeing a 50 to 100% increase in the number of people. And I think if you talk to anyone, you know, Feeding Chittenden or any food shelf or meal site in the state, they're seeing a huge increase. And they're having to change the way they do business everyone is. You know, it's not in Vermont. If you go to a food shelf, you're mostly going in and shopping. It's like a small store. Now everything is prepacked and grab and go. I know Sue will tell you, Sue Minter, who's coming on at the Capstone Community Action food shelf, they're pre-bagging food and setting it out on the loading dock for people to pick up to reduce human interaction.
Yeah, boy, I would imagine that when you are involved in human interaction, I don't know if you've had an opportunity personally to do this much over the last week or so, but how are people's moods and behaviors changing out there? Have you noticed, if anything?
You know, I frankly was working from home all last week, so I was not out in the field. But what we're hearing is that, you know, from my drivers and other folks who are out in the field, is that people are really working hard to make this work. So people are open to social distancing, to, you know, staying in their cars and just being handed food through the window. You know, of course, we've always, you know, are wearing gloves, and now some of our folks are wearing masks just to be extra careful, that we're not spreading something. I think by and large, people are grateful that the resource is there, and everyone's acting appropriately, and really more than that, with a spirit of community and coming together and knowing that we need to help each other right now.
That determination that I think is really a hallmark of folks in when the chips are down, you know, standing up to help your neighbor, really powerful stuff. We've seen it before in Vermont, certainly after Tropical Storm Irene, and this is a time of trouble. There's no doubt about that, and people do seem to be more often than not banding together. There are some behaviors out there which people have criticized about, you know, hoarding toilet paper and that kind of thing. But have you run into any problems, actually? Let me ask about that, with people who are maybe, you know, coming up to the loading dock where there's food or other materials, you know, toilet paper, for instance, for the taking, and maybe they're taking more than their share. And is there any way to guard against that?
Yeah, well, I think now that most distribution is pre-bagged, that's not really an issue at food shelves or food distributions. And frankly, we haven't been able to dramatically, I think, the way we'll need to ramp up distribution, because the food's still on the way here. And by the way, that includes supplies like hand sanitizer and disinfecting wipes, bags and boxes to our partners so that they can bag up and box up the food and get it out. So we're really getting everything out that we have in our distribution centers, and hoping that the supply chains hold out and that we'll be able to get more coming in. You know, we're ordering every day as quickly as we can.
What kind of a forecast are you seeing there on the supply chains?
I would say wobbly but stable. So what I'm seeing is the major manufacturers and distributors are allocating product, which means that they may reduce your order somewhat. You know, some of them are saying they're reducing orders by 20% or 30%, and not taking special orders or extra orders. But the supply chains are still moving. You know, like I said, we had a truck today. The trucks are still on the road. The manufacturers are still producing. So right now, I'm cautiously optimistic.
244-1777 is the local number in Waterbury. 1-877-291-8255 is the toll-free number. You're listening to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM. My guest is John Sales, the executive director of the Vermont Food Bank. And I believe we do have a listener on the line. Is it Jim from Chelsea?
Yeah, good morning, you guys. John, I've got a question for you. I heard something ambiguous on the internet, and it says that if the rest areas get closed, the hospitality industry, justifiably so, shuts down, and our interstate or big rig truck drivers won't be able to get sustenance to keep going. If that really is true, if that really is the case, is it, I heard that they're not able to just walk up to McDonald's or Burger King because their rigs are too big. They can't drive through, and they won't get service if they walk up to the window. If this really is true, is it possible for anybody like me with a portable gas grill to go to the, let's say, Maple Fields and stop at Hannaford's and get a ton of hot dogs and hamburgers and rolls and just offer it to our truckers to keep them going? Is it possible that it could shut down, that the truckers aren't going to be able to deliver our food?
Well, Jim, I had not heard that. That's good. A really interesting issue. I will have to talk to our operations folks and see if we've heard anything about substantiating that.
Yeah, because we've got to start supporting each other here.
Yeah, I would hope that there are ways that our truck drivers can, you know, stop at a Hannaford themselves and get some grab and go, be able to get out there on the road. I'm assuming that the fueling stations are still open, and so there should be some sort of something being done to make sure that folks are getting food.
Absolutely. I hope so, because if it comes to that, maybe we little people can get a convoy together and put a sign on our car that if you can't get to McDonald's, that hop in the car, we'll drive you down and back.
That's a great idea.
All right. Well, listen, thanks for being there, and thanks for the support. And I get my delivery on Tuesday, so I pray to God these people are going to be safe and be able to get here, too. And thanks.
Thank you, Jim, for the call. Really appreciate it. I'm just looking on Google here. I didn't notice there is a story in the Wall Street Journal. Truckers facing coronavirus hurdles in keeping supply chains moving. Subheadline says potential travel restrictions controls at loading docks slow operations and raise alarms for freight haulers. I had seen some coverage, I think, over the weekend, too, about truckers being very concerned about highway rest areas shutting down. These are facilities people take for granted in their normal daily lives, and all of a sudden they're not available. That is a significant change. And then you kind of go, now what? How am I going to work around this and that kind of thing? I guess we'll have to see how it unfolds.
Yeah, our whole food system really does rely on those supply chains, and we're going to have to keep a very close eye to make sure that they keep moving.
Yeah. Let's talk about, you know, sort of on the ground here a little more, John. What are you hearing from? I mean, I know the food bank, by and large, serves lower income Vermonters. And I'm wondering if there are any particular challenges that they face that are maybe people with more privilege are not facing right now.
Well, I think the most obvious is, initially, and you still hear it, telling people to have 2 weeks of food, go stockpile 2 weeks of food and have that available in your house so that you can shelter in place. There are tens of thousands of families in Vermont and families across the country who are struggling to have 1 day's worth of food in the house. They do not have the resources to stockpile 2 weeks worth of food. And that's where the food bank and our network partners come in to make sure that there are channels available that people can go and get food and maybe stock up a little bit, maybe get a few days worth of food in the house. Also, I want people to be aware that one of the bills that passed Congress and was signed by the president, the response bill, is the second one. Includes some expansion of the Three Squares Vermont program, which is nationally SNAP. It's when you can get benefits to go to the grocery store to purchase food, and it is some of the restrictions have been lifted, and people who are now without income because they've been laid off from their jobs are eligible. So people should consider looking into that. You can actually, we have a 800 number. Or a toll-free number at the food bank. It's 855-855-6181. And you can talk to one of our screeners and find out if you might be eligible for Three Squares Vermont.
That's 855.
Really encourage people, 855.
One more time on that number, John.
Yep. 855-855-6181.
6181. Okay.
They could also text VFBSNAP to 85511.
Okay. Well, this is all very good information, and I do appreciate it very much. John Sayles is the executive director or CEO. I should get your title
CEO.
Right.
I mean, it's I do the same thing. It really doesn't matter.
Okay, top guy. How's that?
Yeah.
At the Vermont Food Bank, which is a statewide network of food service and getting food to food shelves out there in our communities around Vermont, and they're doing great work, and it's not easy for anybody these days, and that sounds like you guys are rising to the challenge, and I really appreciate the update, John.
Thanks, Dave. And before I go, I'd just like to mention that we are a private nonprofit organization, and it's, you know, we have to pay for all this food we're buying. So I encourage people to go to vtfoodbank.org and learn how you can help.
That sounds like a very good idea. vtfoodbank.org. And if you are able to, I'm sure they are accepting donations. So thank you very much, John.
Thank you, Dave. I appreciate the opportunity and the public service that WDEV is providing.
Thank you again. All right. I wanted to just mention a bulletin that arrived in my email box a few minutes ago involving the University of Vermont. And President Suresh Garamella issued a statement this morning. The University of Vermont, of course, a week and a half or so ago, went to a campus shutdown in online instruction only, and they were it was indefinite, I believe, at the time as to how long that was going to be. The latest from President Garamella is that at the University of Vermont, remote instruction will continue for the remainder of the spring semester. So no more on-campus classes at UVM this spring. I'm guessing that other colleges and universities, if they haven't already come to a similar decision, will be doing so in the coming days. President Garamella says, "We are closely monitoring the rollout of this approach, providing support for faculty and students, and making adjustments to ensure a meaningful learning experience for our students. I greatly appreciate the Herculean efforts of our faculty information technology experts and other staff in creating new opportunities for learning, and I applaud and thank our students for adapting so quickly and courageously." Let's see, a second bulletin that was issued today by President Garamella, University of Vermont. Undergraduate students who currently reside on campus in the residence halls, as well as non-local students who live off campus. So this is students, I guess, living in apartments around Burlington mostly. He says, should return to their homes. It has become clear that the responsible course of action in light of the global public health challenge confronting us is to have our students leave campus. I wish there were other options, but this is Suresh Garamella, the president of the University of Vermont. His words, he says, I wish there were other options, but my first priority is student safety and the safety of our communities. We understand that some students may not have viable alternatives. We will work with those who have challenging circumstances to provide emergency options for housing. On-campus residents will receive additional information from the Office of Residential Life within 24 hours. And as for the students who live off campus, he's advising them, strongly encouraging them, actually, is the way he describes it, to return home as soon as possible. He says, many of you share close spaces in a way that presents risks to you and your roommates. What will you do if one of you becomes ill or needs to self-quarantine? Most of you will be better off back home with your family. So that's from the president of the University of Vermont. They are basically ratcheting down on the shutdown that began taking effect almost 2 weeks ago now. They're going to discontinue classes for the remainder of the spring semester, at least on-campus classes. They're doing their instruction online these days. And President Garamella is urging students to leave the area, basically go back home, be with their families. They want people out of the residence halls, and he's urging folks living in the student apartments, that are crowding the streets along the streets of Burlington, get out of town, kids. It's, you got to go home. So that is the best advice from the president of the University of Vermont. He also adds that the university will be issuing credit related to meals and housing. Credit for meal plans will be based on the type of plan and usage to date. A housing credit of $1,000 will be issued to students who leave their residence halls by March 30th, even if their belongings remain on campus. Financial aid awards will not be impacted as a result of this housing meal plan credit. Residential Life will be in contact with further information. After March 30th, no students other than those approved for emergency housing will be able to access rooms, their possessions, and associated facilities until further notice. Residential Life will provide additional instructions for when, how, and you will be able to return to collect your belongings. So this is getting serious, folks, and I hope people are listening and will heed these instructions from the president of the University of Vermont. Any of you who are students out there or family members of students need to get that word and really pay attention to what you need to do. We're all trying to do what we need to do in these very, very difficult times. So fast approach to the bottom of the hour here for some CBS News on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM. When we return, we're going to be speaking with Sue Minter, the executive director of the Capstone Community Action based in Barrie. And we'll be back shortly, folks. Stay with us.
There's comfort in the familiar, but when life presents us with something exciting, we just have to embrace it. With so many of our neighbors producing such wonderful products, we just have to show and tell the world. Come in and see for yourself the old standbys alongside the new. Change is good. The one thing that never changes is our commitment to making your visit a great experience. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
News Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
Thanks for staying with us into the second half hour of our program on this Monday morning, March the 23rd, 2020. Staying on our theme of coronavirus, I don't know that there's really any other news getting covered these days. This is just an unprecedented situation we are all in, and there's so many different angles that it really is basically taking everything else off the table. We wanted to continue on our theme of trying to find out a little bit about how coronavirus may be having disparate impacts on some of our lower income communities here in Vermont, and spoke with John Sales of the Vermont Food Bank. The first half hour, we've got Sue Minter, I believe, from Capstone Community Action on the phone with us this morning. Sue Minter, good morning. Thanks for joining me.
Good morning, Dave. Thanks so much for having us on.
And tell me a little bit, just give me an overview first off about what kind of shape things are in for the Capstone Agency.
Well, first of all, I want to say it is really important to highlight, as you did, the disparate and disproportionate impact that this event, as with natural disasters, has on low-income folks. We are working very, very hard at Capstone and with our partner agencies in the regions we serve, which is Washington, Lamoille, and Orange County, to both address the needs that are coming right now and are escalating quickly, as well as to plan for those we see emerging in the future. And frankly, usually you might think a week or so ahead. We are day-to-day preparing and expanding the services we provide in conjunction with partner agencies like the Food Bank. But specifically, we decided to close our doors but continue to offer and provide all of the services we can, obviously in different ways. For our Head Start families, that has meant, and that's 350 at-risk families we serve daily. We are continuing to be in touch with every family over the phone. We are delivering packets both of meals and activities, including books that CLIF, the Children's Literacy Foundation, have just offered to provide, as well as other essentials. We had a huge donation of soap from we've had donations and we're getting them out there. That's for our Head Start. Probably more acute need is around food. As you know, we offer a food shelf, one of many, but we are the largest volume food shelf. We have 70-plus families through our food shelf every day. We are increasing distribution, but we are doing it as pre-sorted bags as opposed to the shopping sort of experience we normally used to have. So we are mobilizing volunteers for that, and we are also increasing cooked and prepared meals that we also give out through our Community Kitchen Academy. We anticipate being a part of the network that is helping rethink how we support homeless individuals and families. And I'll just mention that right now. As you can imagine, our shelter capacity is already inadequate to address the needs of this community, but in this instance is absolutely inappropriate to address the acute needs of homeless individuals. And so we have been working with the Good Samaritan Haven and the state and regional partners to be in coordination with their needs to reduce density. Right now, as we speak, there are new locations being developed, including motels where homeless individuals will be able to have their own isolated rooms rather than be in congregate settings. And this is so critical because our overriding mission is, as a society, to do everything we can to reduce the backlog that is likely, the surge that is likely to occur at the hospitals. When we look across this country, but not internationally, we see that the healthcare system gets overloaded quickly. So we know the vulnerable families and individuals we serve are likely to be the first ones there. So if a homeless individual comes to a shelter with a presenting condition like a sore throat or fever, they send them to the hospital. We know that hospitals only are going to try to keep in their facilities the most acutely ill, and they're going to ask most people to go home and isolate and try to heal. That is impossible for a homeless individual, so we're creating that opportunity for homeless folks. Capstone is working with our partners to do that, but our role will be to help work with the faith community to provide meals to each and every one of those folks who are housed. And I'll leave it there. There's a lot going on that we can get to, but I'll start with that.
Well, let me ask about the, you mentioned that there's, we're leaning harder on our motels, for instance, for to get more isolated housing for folks who are homeless. Are the motels stepping up? I mean, I'm understanding that the hospitality industry is really not doing much right now in terms of its normal course of business. So, I mean, does that make more rooms available?
Yes. So, certain motels have been cited. The state is working hard to gain the authority to essentially enter into long-term leases with those that would be most appropriate. So that is underway, and the answer is yes. Not every motel is necessarily appropriate. So we have, there's already been a process to locate. And I'll say this, we're also thinking differently about the possibility of using college campus systems that either if the state system is being, you know, folks are leaving, but also, as we know, some independent schools have been closed. So there are other options that everything is on the table, and really it's at the state level that kind of work is happening. And then what we are, as we are actually Capstone helping to lead in conjunction with other partners in our what we call the Thrive Network, that is something that the food shelf is also a part of, but we're standing up what we call a regional command center. This is utilizing the incident command system. That is something that I learned a lot about after Irene and encouraged our network to use this structure, which the state emergency operations structure is also doing. And the point is that as needs arise, we are mobilized in a structure that we can help address the needs. So when the state says to us, we need help with this, And in this case, we are helping make sure we get food distributed to homeless people. We may be involved in helping to transport the homeless folks to new areas, or any other need that's coming up. And I want to say that one of the biggest ways we're going to meet those needs is through local volunteers. And we are creating a volunteer management system and process so that as we hear about needs, we have sort of an army of volunteers organized to help meet the need. And I can talk more about that as we go forward.
I'm wondering about the volunteers. Are there folks who are, you know, more available now because they're out of work?
Absolutely. And I will say it is extraordinary what's going on in communities throughout this state right now at a very grassroots level. Mutual aid societies have cropped up in nearly every town. They are organized through their own communication systems to meet the need. And it is really heartwarming, you know, whether it's Front Porch Forum or their own system. I know that at the very community level, happening to ensure that the vulnerable needs of folks in rural areas can be met by their community members. I will just, can you hear me okay?
Yes. Yep.
Okay. So this is what we learned after Irene, that all recovery is local, and the most immediate needs are, I think, already trying to be met in coordinated fashion at the very local level. I think I can imagine this will be helping, for example, families, homebound seniors, make sure they're getting the food and the medicines they may need. Helping families where there may be someone in isolation because they are quarantined to recover that can't go out and may need their neighbors to help out. I already see this being done as we've done a scan of all the different communities we serve, very creative work being done at the local and also at the town level. For a lot of folks, the municipalities are already taking action and being very proactive. So as a network of service providers, Capstone is engaged in helping to facilitate bigger needs that need support, as well as helping to mobilize and work with those community groups that are already established. But I do want to say to your listeners, if you want to volunteer, we would love to have you as part of our network, and you can call our number, and we should be establishing by the end of today a hotline which will help direct you to becoming an active volunteer. And our phone number is 802-479-1053. We are today setting this hotline up, so I would recommend calling tomorrow. And we look forward to working with all of the folks who are wanting to step up. I know this is in our heart and soul in Vermont to help others, and I know this is a great time of need, and it is because of our passion and compassion and strong communities that we will meet the needs as they evolve, and they're rapidly evolving, and I know we can expect them to increase severely in literally the days and weeks ahead.
Yeah, you know, I just got to point out here, it's sort of interesting to me that it's a terrible thing when somebody loses a job or, you know, is out of work for whatever reason. They were working right along and all of a sudden, you know, the owner of the restaurant said, we got to shut down per order to the state. I'm sorry, but we're done for a while. And now that personal crisis of losing a job like that actually opens up an opportunity here. You know, you may have thought all the while you were working full time, I'd love to volunteer, but I don't have time. Well, now you have time, and now there's a huge need. And somehow, you know, sometimes the really bad stuff that happens in the world actually opens up opportunities for leveraging some good. Is that a good way to describe it, Sue?
Absolutely. And I know, of course, I keep remembering, and this is a lot of flashback for me, to Tropical Storm Irene in 2011 when when at that time I was in the transportation agency at the beginning and the sort of response to the emergency phase, and then I evolved into head of recovery for the whole state. It was because of the generosity and quick action of volunteers helping neighbors throughout Vermont that really made it possible for us to recover as well and as quickly as we did. The faster that we respond and the more prepared we are for what is ahead and set up to manage meeting the demand, that is going to really have an impact on our ability to recover quickly and reduce the spread of this coronavirus. Everyone's most important job is to stay home to the best of their ability, to stay 6 feet away from anyone they might encounter. And then we will work to mobilize support in different ways, just like the schools are doing. It's just extraordinary. I do see for vulnerable Vermonters, food access is absolutely one of the most acute needs that we are working with Food Bank and others to address.
Your talk of planning ahead, I'm just thinking, is so important now, and trying to imagine what things could look like in a month, because I mean there was some public official, I think at the federal level, I don't recall who it was, but it was quoted over the weekend in one of the news reports I read as saying that we should expect that April will be worse than March, and May may be worse than April, and so this is not going away immediately, folks. And we are, I think, used to a life in America where an awful lot of what we get emotionally wrapped up in ends in a couple hours, whether it's a ball game or a movie, you know. And this is a different animal for sure. So that idea of really trying to imagine what things are going to look like a month from now or 2 months from now, and how we need to be responding to that condition right now, I think is really something that people are starting to think about, and that is a necessary thing.
Yeah, I think the sooner we wrap our heads around the severity, scope, and length of this likely event, the easier it is for us to manage it. Now, I also want to emphasize that it is not forever. It is, I agree, going to get worse over the next 2 months and then likely better. That's if you look at what's happened in other countries, depending on the sort of level of intensity with which they respond in terms of reducing people's exposure. You know, they took quite draconian measures in China. They had a rapid escalation and then a very rapid de-escalation. Our goal here, because we are lucky that we are maybe days, maybe a week ahead of many of even our neighboring states in terms of our ability to respond and mitigate the spread, our hope is to, as the governor says, flatten the curve, have fewer people ill enough to be in the hospital, and thereby it could mean that the curve goes down more slowly. But I agree that as much as we know right now, actions have been taken for a two-week period, I think that we should be considering the likelihood that it will be a couple of months, perhaps even more than three. But that also, the more we do now, the easier this time period will be. And it is a time where I think in new ways we're going to be able to support one another. We'll be doing it a lot over the phone and over our computers if we are lucky enough to have them, but maybe individuals dropping a care package at the door of another individual, not interacting but supporting. Maybe it's being on the other end of a phone line if someone is having a lot of anxiety and could utilize that kind of a network of support over the phone. Those are the types of activities that we are envisioning we need volunteers to do. And in some places, it's already happening. When I say we, again, it's we have set up a network of the service providers, and this is right now in Washington County. And We are every day meeting in the morning to determine what needs to be done that day, and then in the afternoon to assess what needs to be done, what has been done, as well as determining already what's going to be done the following day. Now, that is the sort of what they call the battle rhythm of an incident command, that there are morning meetings, there are evening meetings, and in between people do work. And that's where we are. We're assessing what we can do today and then what we have to already plan for tomorrow. With the volunteers in this listening in, not everyone can help, but if you are inspired to help, I know we'll probably be able to utilize you in some way. And again, I'm just going to put the number out, 479-1053. And another way you could be helpful is to sort of assess what you think are the needs going on in your area, because we're also trying to understand what are existing needs. I know that church communities or faith communities are already convening, and we are trying to say, okay, there's a lot of needs being met. What needs aren't being met? And that's the role that this regional command response center can play.
Sue, you're going to think this is an odd question, but are there any examples of systems or programs or approaches that you wish you had in place before this came along? Anything, you know, I'm just sort of trying to imagine eventually there'll be sort of a lessons learned kind of a period. Anything popping up yet that you're saying to yourself, boy, I wish we'd had more of blank?
Actually, I'm not feeling that way right now. I'm feeling, I know that my team at Capstone has really stepped up to meet the goal that we established early on, which was to maintain critical services while mitigating the risk of spreading the virus. We've done that in very innovative ways. And because of that, now we are able to think regionally and across all the different vulnerable population groups with our community partners. And we're able to do that because we already have been working as a partnership with monthly meetings. So it's been very natural for us to use that collaboration and regional-wide perspective. You know, we're looking at, when I say vulnerable populations, I'm thinking about homeless people as perhaps the highest priority because of what I said before, how critically important it is for there to be a place for homeless people to self-isolate safely and have access to food. And as I mentioned, those are going to begin with motels that are being fitted up for that purpose. But also homebound seniors, others, people with disabilities, people with acute mental health challenges. These are all the vulnerable populations that we are really thinking about. How do we support their needs immediately, and how do we prepare for what their needs might become? I guess one of the things that we are utilizing, as many groups are technologies that enable us to work together, whether that is Zoom. Lots of groups are having Zoom chats. Family Zooms, friend group Zooms. We had a sit down by the fire Zoom with our friends in other homes. So those technologies and that innovation is rapidly being utilized, and thank goodness it's available. I guess I can say is the wish I had is that we didn't have a system where so many people are homeless and food insecure. I think in some of the other countries managing through this disaster, they aren't having to figure out community systems to feed and house people. So that would be one thing I guess I can reflect upon. But given the situation we are in, we are mobilizing quickly. And I know that some of the lessons from Irene, innovation, collaboration, and very much local response and swift response, those are all key.
Those are key. Sue Minter, I thank you so much for joining me this morning. It's great talking with you. Let's stay in touch, and as we work our way through all of this, and I wish you the best of luck and continued good health and all that, and for you and all yours there, Capstone and your family, etc. So thank you.
Thank you, and I just want to say to everyone out there, do everything you can to stay healthy and be grateful we live in this amazing state because we are Vermont strong.
There we go. All right, let's go to a thanks again, Sue. Let's go to a top of the hour news break from CBS News. A couple words from our sponsors, and we'll be having a one-on-one conversation with a CBS reporter on the other side. Back in a few, folks.
Lawson's Finest, classic clothing in cutting-edge fashion. Our huge sandwiches and grab-and-go meals, toys, a wide selection of rosé, jewelry, accessories, quarter-pound cookies, and even more beer. Yankee Magazine doesn't call us the best one-stop shopping in Vermont for nothing. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world-famous.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
We are back, and we're going to be talking this hour. Among the people we're going to be talking with, are Tim Ash. He's the president of Pro Tem of the Vermont Senate. He's going to fill us in on some of the statewide response to the COVID-19 crisis. But leading off, we're going to be speaking with Pam Falk of CBS News, getting some of the sense of the national headlines out there. Good morning, Pam.
Good morning, Dave. It's grim, but there are a few research bright linings, and that's that there are some researchers who believe this is seasonal. In other words, there will be a lull during the summer. Now, that's a few months away, but right now there's a spike in the Congress, and a procedural vote failed to move forward with this $2 trillion economic stimulus, and the latest is, of course, the futures fell quite a bit on the Dow, and the markets are just really jittery on what to do. Now, deaths worldwide is 15,000, and it's over 350,000 internationally, and everyone's been following that because countries that people thought weren't going to be affected, like India, somehow had no numbers. Once they're testing, they're seeing very big numbers. And of course, 35,000 in the United States with over, I mean, you're heading for 500 deaths, and Vermont itself has its share with, from what I've seen, 49 cases. 49 cases. And so part of the issue is how are people dealing with all of this stay at home? Is it actually going to mitigate? No one thinks it's going to cure at this point, but at least it can stop the tremendous infectiousness of this illness.
Yeah, that is the obviously, I think, you know, it's slow it down, it's flatten the curve.
Right.
It is just try to prevent. I think really what the aim here is to prevent instances of the disease, as opposed to, I mean, because once people catch the disease, the disease in the individual is pretty much going to do what it wants to do. If you have some underlying health problems, maybe you're a senior citizen, it may end up hitting you a lot harder, and including fatally. Although I've seen news reports. I saw one over the weekend, tragically, a 12-year-old girl on a ventilator fighting for her life with COVID-19. And
it just depends exactly, Dave, on your on your internal composition, and it's random. I mean, you could also get. You could be more exposed than someone else. If someone is in a big room with someone and just happens to pass by and get it, it might be a lesser case. And so doctors the voice of wisdom seems to be these days, Dr. Fauci at infectious diseases on the national level, sometimes not always taking the same line as the Trump administration, but what you have to do is at least believe they're all saying stay out of contact with other human beings. So it's very tough. I mean, people are finding their way through to video chats with family, CBS did a nice report about it's Steve Hartman, who always does these on the road reports, and they did a report of his daughter's at home doing tea parties with her friends. So
I have to confess that some neighbors and I and my wife got together yesterday for what we called a Zoom happy hour.
Yeah, exactly. There's a big story in the Wall Street Journal, same as you, Dave. I mean, with the CEO of, I think it was Costco, having a happy hour with his staff. So from his home in Long Island, Sag Harbor. So it's, and I, if we want to give our personal stories, plan to have my birthday party with my sons and my family on a Zoom chat tonight. So
wow. Happy birthday,
I know,
fam. I didn't realize.
Everyone keeps saying, you'll remember this birthday.
Yeah, well, my birthday was a week ago, and that's what I said.
It's
about the weirdest birthday ever, but, you know, you got to make do, and there you go. That's how it goes.
Right. I mean, part of what the UN is worried about these days, Dave, is the recession. I mean, the recession that is already here and a possible global depression that could come a result. Now, one would hope that, you know, China bounced back, opened its Apple stores, things are sort of moving forward. But how much will be lost in the time until it all gets sorted out? So that's what people are really worried about is, I mean, everyone knows someone who's lost their job. And part of the question is, where do the restaurants and the services and everything else come back when everybody can move back into the stream of commerce? So, you know, it hits people in different ways. And it's very unifying in that way. It's like after 9/11 where people are chipping in. So we'll see. The race is now to get some kind of a treatment. Or prevention.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Pam Falk of CBS News, I want to thank you so much for joining me this morning. It's good talking with you. Let's do it again soon.
Absolutely, Dave. Happy birthday belatedly.
And you today. Okay.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you again. Joining me this morning on the telephone is State Senator Tim Ash of Chittenden County. He is President Pro Tem of the Vermont Senate. And good morning, Senator. Thanks for joining me.
Good morning, Dave.
See, I'm not... there you go. Thank you. Thanks for being there. Give us the top headlines that you're seeing and hearing from the sort of statewide response, you know, by state government here. What should people be aware of this morning?
Well, there's no shortage of things that people should be aware of. All throughout the state, our emergency response team are scrambling to get as much needed medical supplies as possible. That ranges from the basic stuff like cleaning supplies to the more complicated things like ventilators, and doing everything we can to both organize all the ones that exist in Vermont to be dedicated to fighting this virus, and trying to get as much from federal stockpiles as possible, and trying to enlist the private sector as much as possible as well. On the legislative front, we will be passing some emergency measures tomorrow. They're primarily focused on giving our health services industry the flexibility to meet this crisis in ways that they would be maybe more constrained under normal times, and providing unemployment insurance to a broader category of the workforce who are disrupted as a result of the virus, and protecting employers from suffering any penalties as a result of having to lay people off because of the crisis. So there's so many moving parts right now, and it's just it's an amazing pace. You know, just 10 days ago, we wouldn't have conceived of it's one thing to have the sense of being at a fire hose, but it's like we've got 100 fire hoses shooting at us at the same time.
Yeah, and I was looking at a very comprehensive and well done, I think, page or executive summary from the State Emergency Operations Center. This is actually dated last evening, but I assume that very much of the information here is still good. One of the things that I mean, I'll just give you an example of what the sort of stuff they're putting out. It says Division of Fire Safety sent guidance on fire department operations, as well as guidance to fire wardens through Forest Parks and Recreation. All state and county court buildings are closed to the public with restricted access in emergent cases. I know that it's like a lot of other institutions in our society, the shutdown has kind of come in stages. The courts initially did it probably, you know, let's call it an 80% shut down. They're at about 95 now. They can still conduct hearings for, you know, if somebody's coming in to be arraigned on a crime that just occurred, you know, a serious crime that just occurred the day before or whatever, that can still happen. But it's a it's getting to be and routine public access to these buildings, the state buildings, the courthouses, not happening right now. So you really you've got to reach out in other ways to get a hold of state officials these days, and they're still working. They're very much, I'd say, the state employee corps is very much, from what I see, stepping up and wanting to provide public service. But the logistical issues of social distancing really require that you know, you can't go stand in line at the DMV these days.
Yeah, it's. I think this crisis has really highlighted how many ways state government impacts people's daily living. And the courts, I'm glad you bring that up. We had the head of the judiciary, the chief judge, yesterday speaking to a group of legislative leadership, and you know, painted a picture of having to change basically court operations overnight. And on the surface, people who aren't, you know, frequently going in front of courts or having legal proceedings might not appreciate the full range of what that means. It's not just people who get arrested and whether they, you know, whether they go through the process of arraignment and bail hearings and all that, but all the people who have, whether it's adoption proceedings, family court, the people who are trying to deal with wills or estates, which actually I think is increasing right now because people are concerned about their vulnerability to the virus, all sorts of civil proceedings, financial transactions. A lot of it has now bottlenecked because while our courts have some capacity to do video hearings, it's actually rather limited. And so the DMV, another example, I'm glad that the governor's team issued an executive order basically preventing the need for people to go in to the DMVs by giving extensions for virtually every major transaction that would otherwise be required. So it's requiring government to respond very quickly. And I'm really proud of the people who work in state government for how nimble they've been in such a short period of time. I mean, it's really hard to imagine shifting an 8,000 or so person workforce so quickly.
One of the you mentioned extensions granted by in this case the DMV, but the, other extensions people think about this time of year from the government oftentimes have to do with taxes. And I see that the federal government has basically pushed off its tax deadline. The normal filing deadline of April 15th will now be July 15th. Do you know, I've lost track of this one, maybe it's already out there or whatever, but is the state doing the same thing, Tim?
Well, the state was planning to issue guidance on Friday in regards to taxes all across the board, you know, income filings, rooms and meals, sales tax. However, it was Friday that the federal government said that not only would they waive penalties through July 15th, but they were actually changing tax day to July 15th. So right. Individuals and businesses who haven't filed their taxes yet in the, you know, with April 15th deadline in mind, now don't have to till July 15th. Vermont's taxes derive from your federal tax forms. So if you haven't filed your federal taxes, you really can't file your state taxes for most taxpayers. So this is that obviously caused the Vermont Tax Department, their plans got thwarted on Friday. We expect that by the end of today, they will issue more guidance. I suspect they will have to extend the filing deadline, at least for many taxpayers, or at a minimum, not have any consequence if you file your form but don't include any payment. Now, from a cash flow point of view for the state, this presents real problems. So we're going to have to work our way through it. But I do want to make clear, if people file their forms and expect a refund, they will get it. So it's not that you cannot file your taxes. It's that you will not face a consequence if you hold off.
I see. Okay. That is something I think will give some people some comfort, because, you know, one of the things that strikes me is this is the time of year when basically inquiries to the tax department really step up. They usually staff up to some degree, I think. And and that may be difficult. Certainly can't walk in right now and get your questions answered. So that is
People's expectations in terms of the speed that they get a customized response. I mean, we're really having to beg patients' understanding and frankly a little compassion as people call offices that are receiving thousands of inquiries a day now. Our unemployment insurance office, which because we've had such low unemployment over the last bunch of years, typically gets a trickle of calls a day. When they shut down the restaurants and bars, I mean, in one day we made many, many, many thousands of people unemployed. And so the systems that are in place under normal circumstances were just overwhelmed almost immediately. So, what I do ask, and this is a message that's unified with the governor, with the speaker, is that as people face the immediate consequences of all of this crisis that we're facing, understand that the person who's there to serve you is on facing a volume probably 100 times more than normal, and your compassion when you're dealing with them will go a long way.
The State Emergency Operations Center notice that I saw last evening actually, interestingly enough, goes beyond Vermont and mentions some of what's going on in other states. It says that stay-at-home orders have been gone out in states including New Jersey, Illinois, and California. All non-essential businesses have been ordered to close in the states of Connecticut, New York, and Pennsylvania. Neither of those two orders have, we're close to, I guess, closing most non-essential businesses in Vermont, but we haven't had formal orders in either respect yet, have we?
We only have, the closures of schools, childcare, the, close contact businesses, which goes into effect tonight. What I think the governor is trying to, is struggling through right now. I shouldn't say struggling through, but having to balance is many of the states who have stay at home orders have so many exemptions that it really doesn't look that different from where Vermont is right now. So, in some ways it's an expression of intent to get people to stay at home unless they absolutely need to leave home. And I think the governor, as he's eased in with more closures, has effectively put Vermont in the same shape as some of these other states. I find it really quite jarring when you see states like Maryland and Virginia. Maryland has been very aggressive with closures. Virginia has done essentially nothing. And so most days, if you read the Washington Post news stories, all the people on the Maryland-Virginia border, and there are many, many people who fall into that category, are driving right over. They're driving over into Virginia. They're going out to eat. They're going to bars. They're getting all their services, and then they're going right back. So any effect of the shutdown in one state is being undone by the lack of coordination with the next state over.
It is just amazing when you think about how difficult it is to shut down a virus. I mean, I think back to the president's order of restricting people traveling from China to the United States way back on January 31st. And we still end up with coronavirus in all 50 states. And, that January 31st order did not apply to U.S. citizens coming home. And you wouldn't, I mean, ideally, you certainly wouldn't want it to. You want Americans to travel freely and be able to come back to the United States after going abroad for a while if they want to. I find that the practicalities of this thing are really, really difficult.
They sure are. I mean, and to stop a pandemic truly in its tracks, if it was back in January, you would have had to truly close the borders and then hope that people hadn't already come in who were infected. And in every state facing this, we know there are people who are going to have to leave their home to keep society functional. And that's everybody from healthcare to personal care attendants for people who are homebound to meal production, there are going to be human interactions, which of course is the very nature of this, the spread of this virus. And at this point, I think I've had many disagreements with the Scott administration on policies. I think that their team has, under extraordinary pressure, been making measured decisions to promote public health. Sometimes they're facing a lot of pressure to, in terms of the timing of different decisions, but it has been heartening that, generally speaking, that people have really united in trying to make smart decisions. And we know there are still some people whose behavior are putting other people at risk. There are some people who think that this is all overblown. I welcome them to meet me in a public park to tell me it's overblown after this thing's over, and I'll be glad they're alive to tell me that.
Yeah. Wow. All right. That is a sobering thought, I must say. And I think that by and large, though, Vermonters are really stepping up here and doing the responsible thing and actually stepping outside themselves and doing very, very helpful and kindly things as well.
Yeah, agreed. It's been amazing to see the local initiative, whether it's mutual aid organizations, which have popped up to provide help to people who are homebound, provide meals to people who can't get out or people who are quarantined, people who are volunteering to make, to use laser printers to make protective masks for our hospitals if they can't get access to them, people who are volunteering to fill in on Meals on Wheels deliveries, knowing that many of the typical drivers are of retirement age and therefore are fairly vulnerable. So all across the state, you see exactly the spirit that we like to think about Vermonters, but we see it in real time playing out in every community. It's just, it's one of the silver linings of this whole mess is that we see people at their best.
Tim, just a couple of minutes to you. I just wanted to circle back to you were remarking on some legislation you expect will pass tomorrow. And I know there's been some real logistical concerns about, 30 senators in that relatively small room. It sounds like you are planning something completely different, though, right? What is basically taking turns and walking in and casting a roll call vote or something? Or how's that going to work?
Yeah. Some people have said, why do you have to go in to cast a vote and not vote remotely? And the thing is, the Senate rules require that people be in their seat when they're voting. And we can suspend those rules, but the cruel irony is we have to actually be there to suspend the rules to allow us to not be there. What we have before us tomorrow will be provisions that we believe are essentially unanimous consensus emergency measures, and all members of the Senate and of the House understand that that is the intent. So what we have encouraged people to do is to not come to the Senate to vote unless they feel that they're at low risk of infection, so that if we can have just 16 people there, which is the minimum number, that we are protecting the most people from potential spread. We will space out the number of people who are in the chamber to vote. They'll all be able to listen in other parts of the state house as we walk through what's in the bill. And then we will do a sort of a slow roll call, if you will, where people will come in groups of maybe five, so that we restrict the number of people. It's also been tricky. I mean, the state house is closed right now to the public and to staff. So we're also wanting to make sure people can follow the work that we're doing. And so we are going to have a plan to allow media access. But even there, we're worried about their safety and want to make sure that we're both doing our work with the scrutiny of the press, but also not having unnecessary numbers to put people at risk.
Well, I wish you luck in working it all out and getting through it tomorrow. Tim Ash, President Pro Tem of the Vermont Senate, thanks so much for joining me this morning. I really appreciate it.
No, thank you, David. Talk to you soon.
Yep. We're going to take a break for some bottom of the hour news from CBS News and be back in a few minutes, folks.
There's comfort in the familiar, but when life presents us with something exciting, we just have to embrace it. With so many of our neighbors producing such wonderful products, we just have to show and tell the world. Come in and see for yourself the old standbys alongside the new. Change is good. The one thing that never changes is our commitment to making your visit a great experience. The Warren Store, where funky friendly, and almost world famous.
News Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
Thanks for staying with us into the last half hour of our program this morning, March 23rd, 2020. And my next guest is Mike Donahue. Mike is a longtime reporter in Vermont, most of his career at the Burlington Free Press, multiple award winner, and very highly regarded journalist in the state. And Mike, you are still a working reporter, even though you technically retired from the Free Press a couple of years ago, a couple of years back. But you've been running into some issues lately with all these meetings happening remotely and so on. And I wanted to check in with what you're seeing and hearing out there in the field as a reporter on that stuff, as well as I think you've got some concerns about possible changes in Vermont's open meetings law that that may be coming down the pike. So let's get right into it.
Sure. Well,
thank you for joining me, first off.
No problem. Thanks for the invite. You're right. I mean, there are some concerns, and it's more the hat I wear as executive director of the Vermont Press Association, which is involved with the 11 daily and about four dozen non-daily papers that are out there in the communities covering these local meetings, that, you know, some of the editors, publishers, and reporters are concerned about how they're going to be able to continue to report on COVID-19 in their community and other issues during this coming three or four months or however long this thing lasts.
Yeah, I actually, I've seen some remarks from public officials and others saying that some of the complaints that we're hearing are a little bit misplaced right now, because, you know, the response you're getting are things like, look, things are really, really difficult right now. Not everything is going to run as smoothly and as nicely as we want and generally see. And when we're in normal times, these are not normal times. We have to take extraordinary measures, et cetera. What are your thoughts on that kind of reasoning?
I think now more than ever is when we actually need transparency in both our state government and local government. I mean, I am pleased that, you know, it seems like Governor Scott and his administration had been very forthcoming, as best we can tell, about what's going on. I mean, as you know, when the two deaths occurred, they issued an announcement saying there was going to be a press conference. They gave the media about 45 minutes notice, and which probably was, as I had posted on Facebook, bad news is coming, ladies and gentlemen, and it was, that two people had died. But they were right on top of it, and they've stood there and they've answered the questions as best they could. And, you know, they are being as transparent as ever. And I think the newspapers across Vermont and presumably TV and radio just want to make sure that that filters down to the local level. I was advised that there was a special meeting the other night in one of the towns, and the newspaper that is supposed to get notices of all special meetings never got notified. So there was some actions taken and everything like that. So the VPA members, you know, have been essential in delivering the COVID-19 news to Vermonters. They want to continue delivering that. You know, hundreds of thousands of Vermonters go to the pages to find out what's going on, as far as, you know, the sickness, the deaths, the symptoms, you know, what's closing, you know, what are the latest statistics, what are the needs of Vermonters, you know, stores that are opening early for the elderly. I mean, they all turn to newspapers and the media in general. And, you know, I think we just want to make sure that the same access, or relatively same access, to meetings continues. And, you know, we support the concept of remote meetings. You know, we need to take steps to ensure, though, that Vermonters can actually hear what's going on or see what's going on. And I'll just tell you one, like, there's one or two quick issues I could tell you about that up for debate.
The Senate is supposedly going to vote on a bill tomorrow about open meetings. But one simple thing is whether these meetings during this crisis time need to be recorded. The Vermont League of Cities and Towns, we've been told, does not think meetings need to be recorded. Secretary of State told the Senate the House Government Operations Committee yesterday that he strongly wants meetings recorded. He just thinks that for historical purposes, and the irony was that I pointed out yesterday, and he did too, during the discussion, the legislative counsel, the lawyer for the committee, was talking, and suddenly his phone dropped, and he was lost during his presentation. And they continued on, and he finally got hooked back into the cell phone or the call-in and everything like that. But, he missed, 5 or 10 minutes of conversation and or presentations by other people. So
yeah,
how would he know what was said? But if it's recorded, he can obviously go back and hear it. And I actually got dropped off the call at one point. There were people dropping off the call. So, the recording is probably 99% of the meetings are recorded by towns now. So I think that's, one of the problems that, hopefully can be quickly fixed when they come in tomorrow.
Yeah, that's those are going to be key issues, and I'm glad that you are bird dogging them, Mike. I gather that you must be getting a little, maybe more than the usual amount of pushback on this stuff from folks who are maybe not as friendly to the idea of openness as a fundamental aspect of government. There's always that element in the conversation, but. I would think that now you may be getting a little more little additional pressure, as someone who advocates for open records, open meetings. Is that the case? Would you say?
Yeah, but whenever there's tough times, people say, "Hey, just trust us. Let us do our job." I've often said down there, we understand that it's difficult to have people looking over your shoulder. I mean, a lot of people in the legislature work in private business and nobody's looking over their shoulder. Mm-hmm. Suddenly they come into Montpelier and, the doors are open, the files are open, the hearings are open, and suddenly people are looking over their shoulders as they're making legislation. And, it's a whole new concept sometimes for some of the legislators to suddenly have the spotlight shined on them and everything like that. And same at the local level. People are like, well, just let us go over in the corner and figure this thing out. We'll come back and tell you. Well, no, why don't you do it in front of everybody? I'll give you one other thing in the bill, which we're scratching our heads over. As you know, minutes of meetings are supposed to be available within or after 5 calendar days. And suddenly this bill increases that to 10 days. And we're scratching our heads as to how that came about. Apparently the league is pushing that. That's an old push that they've had that's been defeated 3 or 4 times, but they've slid this in this time again. But what people are telling us is, there's more time now to crank out the minutes. There's less distraction. People want the news now. They don't want to wait 10 days. So, why are you delaying the minutes of what boards are doing and everything like that? And the irony is a lot of the town offices, and I think most, if not all, they say they're closed, but we're still going to be working inside doing town work and everything like that. So they're free to do the minutes. They're just not going to have the foot traffic of people paying their taxes, people coming in for dog license renewals, and all the things that happen every spring or everything like that. But
yeah,
they can be cranking out minutes. And minutes of meetings take, 20 minutes to half an hour to produce. And suddenly they're going from 5 days to 10 days to get those drafts out, you know, which is
now was this an addition of time, something that had been pushed for since, I think you told me this, since long before the coronavirus outbreak, right?
Yeah, I mean the League of Cities and Towns, when there was several efforts to improve the open meeting law, that was one of the, if you will, improvements that they suggested, is expanding from 5 to 10 days or even more the time to get minutes out. And the legislature has continuously refused to let me back up. They were going to have a two-tier system at one point where you could have your minutes out in 5 days, and then they had another 5 days to put them up on a website so somebody could read them. So, you know, the Senate and the House said, we're not going to have a two-tier system. We're going to stick with the 5 days. It only takes two or three keystrokes to put them up on a website once you have them. You know, and again, this is about transparency and getting the information out to the public. I mean, if the town is going to tell people you don't have to pay your taxes, you know, on the 30th this year, you know, we're going to give you a 30-day extension. I mean, if the minutes don't come out until after that time, then what good was the motion during the meeting to extend everybody an extra 30 days to pay their taxes or something? So, you know, we just see that as, you know, just the latest, you know, one more run at this on something that's been defeated 3 or 4 times. And I think somebody raised it to me is, if they do get it passed now, you what? They're betting that as soon as the crisis is over, they're going to say, see, it didn't really hurt. Let's keep it at 10 days, you know. So,
right.
You know, it's...
Mike, what do you know about access to the courts right now? Is that something that is, I mean, they're operating a very limited way. I don't know if that's how that's impinged on you, you know, if you're a reporter who wants to find out what the latest court filing is.
On the federal court system, they have a system called PACER, and you can sign up for it, and you can have access to filings the very day that they're filed and everything like that. And in the court, federal court in Burlington, and presumably I've been to Rutland, but, you know, the two federal courts are open. They have reduced staff in there, but most of the hearings are postponed. Obviously, if somebody gets arrested, they have to bring them before the magistrate judge right away. You know, but there's very limited cases going on in federal court. In the state court, again, they've really cut down. They're not letting a whole lot of people into the building. As a matter of fact, when I went down to courthouse in Burlington, Costello Courthouse, initially they said media was not allowed in, and I called the chief clerk, and she said, no, that's... you guys are allowed in. And I was glad to go in and get the file that I needed and everything like that. But
right,
it's there's a whole lot of things being slowed down, and you know, there are people concerned about, you know, speedy trial. Although we don't really have speedy trial in state court, there is federal law that says you're supposed to have your trial within 70 days of essentially when you're indicted and everything like that. And they hold that near and dear in Vermont and across the nation, I guess, too.
Sure. And which is all, I mean, I think what we've had these arguments before in sort of normal times about government service. I've heard government officials say, the dissemination of information about what we're doing is not our primary purpose as a government agency. I usually argue back from that every bit of what a government does essentially revolves around the dissemination of information. You know, if you are passing a law, enforcing a law, interpreting a law, passing the legislature, enforcing the executive, and interpreting the judiciary, you are basically dealing in information there. All that law is a piece of information. And I try to emphasize with public officials when we're getting sort of philosophical about this stuff that information is basically the stuff of government. And so for government officials who want to say that's not our primary role is to provide information to the public, I think they really need to rethink that, I suspect.
No. Yeah, I mean, you hit it right on the head. I mean, and again, what they do is on behalf of the 650,000 or whatever it is, Vermonters, and they need to know what they are doing, whether they're extending deadlines, whether they're shortening things, whether, you know, things are being open, things being closed, you know, whatever. And now, during a crisis like this, now more than ever, they really need to be as transparent as they can be. Again, I was quite pleased with what we've seen so far on the state side. I will chuckle a little bit. I didn't get much notice of the hearing yesterday, 15 minutes on, I think, probably for the House committee. And when I got an email telling me what phone number to call in on that was distributed to the agenda, it only had six numbers instead of seven.
Wow. Somebody made a typo.
I don't know how many people were shut out of that, conceivably being able to dial in. I sent emails to a couple of legislators on the committee and the staff member of the committee and said, you know, how do I get in? And one of the legislators called me on his cell phone and hooked me in that way. And like I said, for a while I was on there, and then I got dropped off, and I got hooked back in. So it's essential. It's as if, well, I think all we're looking for is that, you know, that we continue to be able to monitor what goes on at the local level in a reasonable way. I will just say in closing that, you know, I went to a meeting the other day, South Burlington School Board. I mean, they had Zoom, they had the local access channel broadcasting it live. I mean, there are a lot of ways that things can be done to get the public and keep them engaged.
Sure. Hey, Mike, hang in there. I want to bring in a listener. Bruce from Essex is on the line. Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning, both of you, and Mike, good to hear your voice again.
Hey, Bruce. Hiya.
Mike Donahue is one of my heroes, okay? And I was on the select board in Essex. He only covered us for about a year or so. Every time he came on, our town manager started sweating. And Mike raised the procedures by which we should go into executive session. And I think the violation of the public open meeting law and public records laws is probably a much greater issue than we can deal with right now. I can tell you from my experience on the select board in Essex, I had to threaten to sue the board to get the town manager's contract. We were in an executive session, and the select board chair brought out a contract renewal, which was not warned, which we were not told about. And I said, I want to see his old contract. And the select board chair said no. And I said, how's it going to look if a select board member sues the select board to get a public document? And so based just on my experience of 3 years on a select board, I've seen numerous attempts to violate the open meeting law. And secondly, on minutes, recognize the state law regarding what has to be in the minutes is so minimal. You know, you don't even have to have a robust discussion. Listen, who was there? You know, who spoke? What was done? Was any action taken? What were the votes? But beyond that, it can be bare bones, and that doesn't serve the historical record or democracy either. So I don't want to belabor the point other than to say kudos to Mike. And secondly, this is a long-standing problem that violates this myth of Vermont as some clean, green paradise. So there you go, guys.
Bruce, I appreciate the I appreciate your views there. I mean, I think you have some experience here, which is quite valuable as a member of a former member of a select board who was trying to get records on the select board. Wow.
Doesn't get much better than that.
And Bruce hits it right on the head. I mean, we have no idea of, you know, when they go into executive session to discuss one topic, I mean, how many other boards, I've been told by board members later, oh, yeah, we talked about two or three other things, too. You know, and there's no way, I mean, I've been a long believer that minutes of executive sessions ought to be mandated.
Or one of the things, too, is have an affidavit signed by each select board member that this is what they discussed. Because you can, there's no prohibition against saying what you talked about in select in session, but and then make sufficient penalties there so that people will be afraid to, you know, that somebody will blow the beans and we went more than this. I mean, it has to be dealt with. And the problem I have with Vermont League of Cities and Towns is it's got this aura of good governance around it, but it's essentially a trade association, and it's protecting its members and their interests. And this is a much bigger issue, but I'm glad you're raising the issue about what they might want to do with at this difficult time. They said they can't record meetings. Well, you can use all sorts of software, online software, and if you pay a little bit for it, the meeting will automatically be recorded, like Zoom. I even think, you know, various other things. You pay for an upgraded service, the meeting will be recorded and a transcript can be issued. So I think they're just using this as an opportunity, a Trojan horse to weaken laws about transparency. So thanks for dealing with it.
Thank you for the call, Bruce. Thanks. Appreciate it very much. The you like to think that people are playing fair and that maybe wouldn't necessarily press an advantage they've been trying to press for years to get something passed that has been defeated before. I mean, it seems like just almost an attack from at a moment of weakness or something, doesn't it, Mike? Or what are your thoughts there?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's why I was and unfortunately, when it was in the Senate, as you know, I had a couple of family members just pass away within a week of each other, and so I was out of the loop.
Yeah, we're very sorry. Condolences about that.
Thank you. And I was sort of out of the loop for a week or so and missed the Senate portion of it. And you know, yeah, I mean, it was like, how did this come up? We've already decided this three or four times, and they're just trying to slide it in one more time. When everybody's guard may be down and everything like that. So
I'm glad you're able to get your guard back up, Mike, and raise the alarm about these issues, because I suspect that there may be merits to both sides of these debates. That's why these debates go on all the time. But I also feel like you know, in this particular case, where if what you're saying is accurate, that this is the same issue that has been raised and defeated before, and we're trying again right now. I mean, maybe there ought to be a constitutional amendment that during states of emergency you can't do this kind of thing. I don't know exactly how you would attack that, but that's a bizarre one, and so I appreciate you raising the issue here. All right, we are fast coming down to the top of the hour here in the end of today's edition of the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. My guest has been Mike Donahue, longtime Vermont journalist and someone who he's also executive director of the Vermont Press Association, and is somebody who's really followed these open meetings and public records debates in our state for a long time. And Mike, I very much appreciate you joining me this morning.
Not a problem. Thanks for the invite. Appreciate it.
All righty. We are, as I mentioned, fast approaching the top of the hour. We're going to stay on, obviously, stay on this coronavirus story for as long as it lasts. Basically, we're going to be talking to folks in Barrie tomorrow about the impacts on that community, on its businesses, and so on. About the coronavirus, we're going to be really focusing like a laser on a wide variety of different angles here on the Dave Graham Show on this story. Stay tuned now for Bill Sayre, Common Sense Radio, coming up next year on WDEV. Don't forget about the 1 p.m. news conference with Governor Phil Scott and Congressman Peter Welch. And don't forget about our podcast. You can always tune in WDEVradio.com. Follow the link to the Dave Graham Show. Scroll down a bit and you'll find a list of our recent programs, including today's, by most likely later today. So thanks for listening, folks. Really appreciate it. All your phone calls and participation are always appreciated as well. Have a great day, everybody. Stay healthy out there, and we'll talk again tomorrow.